rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And happy Monday to you. Greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. I'm Tom Hartman, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, beaming down from outer space in the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, podcasting from whiterosesociety.org and Apple's iTunes. Welcome to our program. With John Roberts being appointed to the Supreme Court, he who has said that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided and should be overturned, he whose wife is an outspoken activist and former chairwoman of an openly anti-abortion group, there's a lot of questions being asked about, can Roe v. Wade be overturned? What might be the consequences of a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade? It's certainly been nibbled away at, chunk by chunk, over the last 30 years. And so we figured we would go right to an expert. In fact, probably one of the finest and most extraordinary experts in the United States on this topic. Catherine Rohrabach has litigated a number of landmark cases. She helped found the Connecticut Civil Liberties Union in 1948, served as legal counsel to Planned Parenthood of Connecticut, the former president of the National Lawyers Guild from 73 to 85, former board member of the American Civil Liberties Union, that from 73 to 85 as well. And perhaps most germane to this, she litigated Griswold versus Connecticut, which is the famous Supreme Court case where the state of Connecticut had said that even a married couple by law could not have birth control in their home, and that got overturned. And then Women versus Connecticut, which was the Connecticut counterpart to Roe v. Wade. Catherine Rohrabach, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Very pleased, honored to have you with us. First of all, give us a quick recap of Griswold versus Connecticut for those listeners who are not familiar with that Supreme Court case. That was 1964, wasn't it?
It was decided in 65.
65, okay.
65. It was a long bit of litigation. Connecticut has had this statute on its books it was illegal to use contraceptives in Connecticut, married or unmarried. And needless to say, it was honored in the breach more than the obedience to it. But the real problem was that doctors could not engage in public advocacy for birth control or give it to patients without being considered
criminals.
Criminals for having aided and abetting the commission of a crime.
Right. Yeah.
So there was no clinics in Connecticut, and this litigation began to try to get, at the start, to get just an exception interpreted into the statute that birth control could, a doctor could prescribe birth control to a woman who would die if she became pregnant again. That was one of the cases we had. Another case was a couple that had three malformed children.
And even in these cases, the state argued that a woman should not have access to birth control.
That's right.
Now, what possible rationale would they have for that?
Well, that this was something the legislature had decided, and we should go to the legislature to get it changed. I mean, in essence, that was what they were saying.
So they didn't try to make a moral argument. They simply said that's the law.
They also did the moral argument, but the basic thing that...
But what's moral about a woman who will die if she becomes pregnant? And
nothing at all.
Yeah,
nothing at all.
Although they tried to claim that it was. And they still are, to some extent, oddly enough, bizarrely enough. Now, was Women versus or Griswold versus Connecticut, Women versus Connecticut, were these cases, did they turn on privacy rights?
Griswold was the final stop of that litigation on birth control, and the United States Supreme Court declared the statute unconstitutional,
mm-hmm.
and they did so on the basis of privacy, that there was a right of privacy in the Constitution that that protected people and their personal relationships.
Was that the Fourth Amendment?
It was keyed specifically to married people, because back in the 50s and 60s, it wasn't recognized that this should be permitted for the unmarried.
Did they find that right of privacy in the Fourth Amendment, or did they find it in multiple places in the Constitution?
They found it actually, Justice Douglas wrote the major opinion in there, that case, in which he said that it was in the penumbra of the Bill of Rights, you know, the shadow cast by all of the Bill of Rights, and especially the search and seizure clause, the First Amendment protection of people in their personal conversations, etc. I mean, he went through all of them, but it was just that there was, it was not a, never said to be a right of privacy in the Constitution, but that it was there because it was part of the fabric of, in essence, the fabric of the society of the time and of the Constitution.
Well, also in 1787, when the Constitution was drafted, the word privacy was a word that a person used if they wanted to excuse themselves to use the toilet.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the mid to late 1800s, when Thomas Crapper invented the flush toilet, that we stopped using the word privacy as a word meaning toilet functions, although there's still vestiges of it. People talk about their private parts, and we talk about privies, as outhouses. It's still vestigial, but...
what's interesting is that in the 50s, especially, privacy became a very crucial concept, because at that time, you'll remember, that was just when the computers were beginning to come into to use, and there was concern, and there was the introduction of Social Security, which had with it a number, and the concern of people that information in your Social Security file should not be available to anyone else, and no restrictions on its use. I think the only permissible use of it was for tax returns.
Yeah, in fact, the original law said that it's illegal for anybody to ask for your Social Security number for identification.
Yeah, yeah.
And that of course, has been eroded over the years.
Gone down the tube. But
yeah.
Also, there were spy planes in the air that could begin to photograph people on the ground, you know, and there was this sense of listening devices, etc. There was a sense that privacy was being invaded on all sides, and the Supreme Court, in fact, wrote a couple of very important search and seizure decisions, one of which was decided during the time that Griswold was going up to the Supreme Court.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes to summarize this. We have Judge John Roberts, probably going to end up on the Supreme Court if all the pundits are to be believed, and well, for that matter, the Democratic members of the House and Senate that I've spoken with in the last week, if they're to be believed. And Roberts is on the record as saying, as an attorney, that Roe v. Wade should be overturned. His wife has been working aggressively toward this end for at least a decade. He's replacing Sandra Day O'Connor, who was the swing vote, who was preventing Roe from being challenged. If he gets on the court and Roe is overturned, what will the consequences of that be with regard to the right to legal abortion, and what would the consequences to that be in broader areas of public life?
Well, if Roe was overturned, you'd still have the problem of, would a legislature adopt an abortion statute?
In other words, would the states recriminalize abortion?
Yeah, and I'm not sure what the answer to that one is. I mean, it's one thing to get rid of a statute, but quite another to try to get one adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at that point, people will begin to remember, as those of us who are old enough, I don't know how old you are, but I was, Griswold got decided in 65, Roe in 72.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, women died from
I'm old enough.
Abortion.
I am old enough that a girl in my high school class died from an illegal abortion.
Yeah.
I didn't know her well, but I knew who she was, and that was not an uncommon story, by the way.
I know, and the
that was in the late
quite
60s.
Apart from the people who died, the people whose lives were ruined by
right rendered sterile or
and that sort of thing. You know, I don't think a younger generation understands just what it was like.
No, they have no recollection.
And I can tell you that in New Haven, Connecticut, even it was just shortly before Rose, during the period when I was doing Griswold and stuff. A lawyer came to consult with me because his client had gone to the hospital with the results of a self-induced abortion. I mean, this was a frequent thing in the emergency room. And when she left, she was arrested for having induced an abortion on herself. And the lawyer had checked and found there was a regulation in the hospital that when a woman came in that condition, it was to be reported to the police.
Hmm. And this is what Judge Roberts, George W. Bush, Gonzalez, certainly Scalia and Rehnquist, this is the America that they want to take us back to.
Right. Well, I think there's much more things to worry about with Justice Roberts than just that issue, frankly.
Okay, in the minute and a half we have left, what's on your mind about Justice Roberts?
Well, I don't really notice, but there was a decision in the district court in Washington, the circuit court in Washington, reversing a lower judge's ruling that the military tribunals that the president has decreed,
right,
organized, that those the lower court had enjoined the use of the military tribunal. The judges of the Court of Appeals reversed that, and it was a three-judge panel, one of whom was Roberts.
And saying that, therefore, we can ignore the Geneva Conventions on the one hand with foreigners, and we can ignore domestic law with regard to Americans or with foreigners who are here on American soil.
Right.
That, standing up with George W. Bush and saying that there's this new third category, you are now under the thumb of the president, period.
Right.
Yeah, this is
and
very troubling.
That this was legal because Congress had authorized it by giving the president such broad powers. And Judge Roberts was part of that decision. So I'd be much more worried about it on that score than I would be on Roe v. Wade, which I think no matter who Bush nominates, that decision is really in very, very
deep trouble.
Peril.
Yeah, great peril. Well said. Catherine Rohrabach, Catherine Rohrabach, who argued Women versus Connecticut, argued Griswold versus Connecticut, one of the leaders in the field, helped found the Connecticut Civil Liberties Union in 1948, lead counsel of Planned Parenthood of Connecticut, the National Lawyers Guild president, 73 to 85. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure.
It was an honor to have you on. And,
thank
and,
you.
And keep up the good work and keep speaking out. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, I am just a student, sir, and only want to learn. But it's hard to read through the rising smoke from the books that you like to burn. So I'd like to make a promise, and I'd like to make a vow, that when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. Oh, you've given me a number, and you've
and
taken
welcome
off
back,
my, name.
My friends. The energy bill coming before Congress would repeal PUCA, the Public Utility Holding Company Act. There you go. Passed in 1935. Make it possible for Enrons to spread all across America. Bizarre happenings with the energy bill. Thank you, Scott Forrester, for the tip on that. Scott engineering our program today and knowing about all things power. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number if you'd like to call in from anywhere in the United States, from outside the United States, 503-248-0620. Ben in Aloha, Oregon on the line. Hey, Ben, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'd like to talk about PGE and Enron. PGE's
okay, just real quickly for our listeners who are not in Oregon, what's going on is that Enron bought PGE, not Pacific Gas and Electric, but the, what is it, Portland General Electric? PGE, the local power company, and basically they've been screwing the ratepayers, in the opinion of many people, for example, collecting taxes that they don't have to pay, taking it from us and putting it in their pockets, giving it to their CEOs, things like that. And the city of Portland, the state of Oregon, we're going to buy it back from them, and they just yesterday or last week, last Friday, said, nope, sorry, we ain't going to talk to you. Tough luck, go away. And now Oregon is facing a problem.
All right.
That said, you were going to say.
Tom, I have had PGE service for most of my 50 or 60-some years, and it's been fine. PGE started a small company, and we imported their electricity out of Portland, and they've expanded. They cover about 4,000 square miles in the largest city in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't even be talking now if Enron had been responsible. The service from PGE was fine. There was nothing wrong with it.
It's until Enron came along. Yeah, until Enron came along.
And when they did what they did to the country, not just Oregon, but to the country, and they crashed, we had an opportunity to buy PGE back from them and operate it as a public utility. Enron is still very much alive, and they're still screwing the public.
There you go. Well said, Ben. I appreciate it. And here are Enron theme music for the day. We'll start over.
Just before our stock did tank, we sold and took it to the bank. The workers still got screwed. It was our intention to build the working dude right out of his pension. We're Enron when Dick Cheney needs power solutions. We are there to discuss, Enron. We gave Bush lots of big contributions. Now he's working for us.
And so Enron has just told the state of Oregon where they can put it. I am expecting others will come. We see the PUCA being repealed as part of the energy bill, this incredibly toxic energy bill, a huge welfare bill for the big energy corporations. We'll find out if that's going to pass, how many of our legislators are going to act like traitors to the United States by voting for it. Yeah, good old Enron. George is working for us. It's the official Enron slogan theme song there. So, you know, we'll see how this plays out. This not just here in Oregon, but around the United States. I'm telling you, the energy bill, this is one of those big deal things that's getting no coverage. We're also going to talk today about what's going on with Treasongate, just as I predicted 1 week ago today, or perhaps as a week ago tomorrow. George W. Bush appears to be at the top of the pile in this. To paraphrase Adolf Hitler, the little worm who comes blinking into the light when he is uncovered. It's pretty awful to paraphrase Mein Kampf, isn't it? Probably shouldn't do that. Anyhow, George W. Bush right there in the middle of it. We'll get to that right after this. 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. On the road again.
On the road again.
Oh, Willie.
Just can't wait to get on the road again.
I'm just back from Chicago, in fact.
My love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road again.
This weekend I was at the ILCA convention, International Labor Communications Association, part of the AFL-CIO.
seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again.
And it was a hoot, I'll tell you. The labor movement is going through a lot of changes right now. And it's really remarkable how many people in the labor movement think that the problems with labor are the fault of labor, and how many people in the labor movement realize that the problems with labor have nothing to do with labor. They have to do with a 25-year, well, actually it goes all the way back to 1947, when in 46 the Republicans took the House and Senate, and over the veto of Harry Truman, passed the Taft-Hartley Act that essentially rolled back parts of the 1935 Wagner Act, which allowed for unionization in the United States. So you've got that, and then on top of that, to make things even worse, Ronald Reagan comes into office in 1980 and declares war against organized labor, against working people in the United States, fires all the PATCO strikers, says, that's it, no more. And it's been downhill ever since. Tragically for the American people, not just for organized labor, for everybody. But it's a whole other discussion, I guess. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Trish in Texas on the line. Hey, Trish, you had some thoughts about energy.
I certainly do, especially here in Texas. Thanks, Tom. I personally, we've gone up 25% with TXU, which our legislative, which is a majority of Republicans, have approved and approved and approved, to where we live in a 1,500-square-foot home. And we keep it at 79, it goes up to 83 at night, and we're looking at $300 a month. And there's no relief in sight, considering it's hot here. And as far as the competition that was allowed to come in, they went away.
Yeah.
They couldn't compete, supposedly. I don't understand what that was.
It's called being driven out of business.
Yeah, but I mean, like, they would come door to door and ask if you'd like to sign up, and they'd guarantee you 1 year of... You know, but then we found out later that they were buying it from TXU and Energy, yeah. And then 1 year was only one guarantee, and then you'd go straight through the roof. This energy stuff, I'm sorry, it was my dog.
That's okay.
This in Texas with this legislative that we have is just beyond words.
I'm telling you, Trish, as long as the Republicans are in charge, you're going to see this kind of situation going on all across the United States, which is basically screw the consumer, help the multinational corporations, because that's their agenda, and they're quite upfront about it.
Well, I was wondering, because I really want to move out of Texas, even though I grew up here and everything. I personally do not want to live here anymore. I need a more liberal state, because you talk about right-winged Christian activists. I mean, this place is not what it used to be in the day.
Let me encourage you to stick around and change it from within, Trish. Texas needs people like you.
No. Well, I'm not the only one here right now.
I guarantee you, Trish, you're not. You're not the only one. Check out Democracy for America and go to one of the meetups and hang out with some of the other fine folks from Texas. You know, Radio Left is actually broadcast out of Dallas. I mean, there's some good folks in Texas. So I encourage you to get with them and get active and get out there. And thanks for calling in. It's great to hear from you. And I salute your passion and your activism. The other solution to this problem, by the way, is community energy. I wrote a chapter about this for a book that Marianne Williamson compiled a few years ago called Imagine What America Could Be in 50 Years. And in my chapter in the book, I talked about community energy sources. I mean, we have now more than 3/4 of the United States gets enough sunlight that if they simply started replacing roofing tiles with photovoltaic solar panels, that is, they actually manufacture these now. The first company to make them was one of the Japanese manufacturers that also makes computers. I forget which one it was. I think it might be Toshiba, but I'm not sure. It was one of the Japanese computer companies, and they were making roofing tiles, roofing shingles that are PV, that generate electricity, and you just re-roof your house with these things, and you put some batteries in the basement to store it up for overnight, and poof, you've got electricity. And certainly, all of the southern states, that would there would be no more need for high power lines, for high tension lines. Well, of course, the big power companies are going to fight this tooth and nail because it means they're out of business. But that's one solution. And in the north, you've got windmill power, you've got geothermal power, you've got communities generating electricity. Somewhere, depending on what part of the country you're in, depending on how far the power lines have to run, and depending on how you calculate losses, typical losses on high-tension lines, the amount of energy that is simply converted into heat and wasted because it's pushed through these long high-tension lines, because we have centralized power plants, is somewhere between 15 and 30% of all the electricity generated in the United States simply wasted. If we had community power stations, if every, say, 12-block area had their own local power station, you say, what, power station, stinky, horrible. No, it's not. It doesn't have to be. A friend of mine lives in Manhattan. Their building generates their own electricity. This is on 8th Avenue and 28th Street. They generate their own electricity. You can't tell. It's quiet. It's in the basement. They burn oil and natural gas, and they actually recycle. They have a part of the trash thing down there. Everybody brings down their papers, and they burn the newspapers and generate electricity from it. I mean, it's just it works. It is possible to have community power systems. It's not just possible. It's a good and healthy thing. So, you know, that's one possibility. Lots of other possibilities as well. So, you know, just wanted to say that. By the way, when we came back from the break, I meant to mention Small Dog Electronics is sponsoring the program, has for several years, a good supporter of this program. And if you are a supporter of this program, please give them a call and ask for information, catalogs, any questions you have about computers, high technology for low prices. Small Dog Electronics. They don't work on commissions. You will get a straight answer from whoever you talk to there. Let me encourage you to give them a call, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Irene in Virginia Beach, Virginia on the line. Hey, Irene, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. Really love your show. First-time caller. You're welcome. I just heard the lady call in from Texas, and I feel for her because I'm from New York originally. We live in the South now, down in Maryland. We've been all over. We're military. But the lady that just called up, there is a nice little newspaper. I mean, it's getting very popular with the liberal democratic people, and it's called the Lone Star Iconoclast.
Right, in Texas.
Right, and so she'd be. I actually subscribe to it, and they mail it to me all the way over to here. But the subscription is much less expensive if you do it online. But it's a really great, very honest, very well done newspaper. And I forget the editor's name, but he does a great editorial. And it might make her feel better.
That's great. Okay. So hopefully she heard your message and she will carry it forward.
Right. Okay.
Okay,
well, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Irene. Great to hear from you. Thank you. I appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Thanks for the call. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. I just, you know, lest we forget, George W. Bush, in his recent speech on energy, in which he was saying, let's please pass an energy bill, he said, we don't have an energy policy in the United States, implying that we never had. I think it's really important that we remember that we once did, that we once actually did have an energy policy in the United States. And that Jimmy Carter was the guy who put it into place.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
That was July 15th, 1979. A year later, as one of his first official acts of office, Ronald Reagan repealed Jimmy Carter's energy policy, removed the solar collectors from the roof of the White House, and now we are importing about five times as much oil as we were then. Jimmy Carter went on to say we should do something about solar power.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
If only we had listened to Jimmy Carter. If only Ronald Reagan had not come into office, we wouldn't be in Iraq, we wouldn't be in the Middle East, we wouldn't be fighting with Hugo Chavez down in Venezuela. We wouldn't be desperate for oil. We wouldn't be blackmailed by Mexico because they're supplying so much oil to us. We wouldn't be $1 trillion in debt to China. We wouldn't have all the messes that the cons have brought to us. Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Will, what's on your mind today?
Tom, great stuff.
Thank you.
Joe and Congressman Bernie Sanders?
Yes. Bernie's on our show every Friday.
Every Friday. Great. At 12 o'clock, right?
Yeah, Eastern time.
You got it. Ronald Reagan, in my opinion, won about 8 Academy Awards, you know, for pretending to be a president. In my estimation, Reagan and Clinton were the two worst. However, you mentioned this energy thing. I remember when I was a young man, Nixon tried to do it with the oil companies. You know a guy by the name of David Walker?
I do not.
He is the Comptroller General.
Oh, you mean right now?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. He just issued a report. In fact, I read this that report on this program about 3 weeks ago, where he was talking about the economic disaster we're facing as a result of the unfunded mandates, and we're not just a few trillion, but when you add in the cost of the new Medicare provision, et cetera, you know, hundreds of trillions of dollars in debt over the lifetime of our children and grandchildren. I think he said that by the year 2040 or 2050, the entire federal budget would be consumed simply paying interest on the national debt that George Bush is running up.
That is correct.
Yeah.
What I have is he also mentioned that no one can tell him where the Pentagon is spending $1 billion a week.
That's right. He said, in fact, if the Pentagon was a private corporation, it would be out of business. It was so badly mismanaged.
Now, also, Vice President Cheney refused. He refused to give Walker. Now, this is the guy who's looking out, who's the GAO, the auditor for the people of America. He refused, Cheney refused to turn over the records for the Energy Task Force. It went to the Supreme Court.
I know. He refused to turn them over to we the people. This was and why? Well, obviously, because number one, we know now from the lawsuit by Judicial Watch and Larry Klayman, the right wing group, by the way, that sued Bill Clinton over Paula Jones that led to Monica Lewinsky. Larry Klayman and Judicial Watch sued Dick Cheney, and we got the documents are on their website at judicialwatch.org. We actually now know that in April of 2001, this was 6 months before 9/11. In April of 2001, Dick Cheney sat down with Ken Lay and other executives of the energy industry and carved up the oil fields of Iraq.
You got it.
They had a list of the names of the countries that were potential suitors within each country, the companies. They had a map of all the oil fields. They named each one of them, the ones that didn't have names. They gave them numbers, and they assigned them to different oil. Well, FINA in France would like this one. And this guy, you know, this company and BP in England would like this oil field. And they were auctioning off the oil fields of Iraq. It's absolutely a crime. And Dick Cheney still won't tell us about it.
I tell you why I love your show. I learn so much information. I can't get it from the government. And I am so glad you're very honest and ethical about your information. And let me say one thing about BP. I tried to go over to solar energy, and also there's also unbelievable energy to be harnessed with windmills.
That's right. Yeah.
I call up guys into the solar energy. I was going to put panels on.
Yeah.
He says, I can't get them. I'm listening to your show on the same station, and all of a sudden, it was a handyman show came on after you. There was a guy from Buffalo who is strictly in the business of solar energy. You're going to love this, Tom. Guess who bought up all the, who's buying up, who produces them? BP.
Yeah, I know. The two largest producers of solar panels in the world right now are BP and Shell.
You got a BP.
Yeah. No, I'm serious. They're the two largest producers of solar panels in the world right now. Will, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. John in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, you know, I just wanted to call because I hear all this talk about energy, and I agree with almost everything that's being said, and I'm a, without a doubt, a progressive liberal Democrat. But my struggle is I'm married to someone who works in the fairly high up in the third largest energy company in America. And I have such a conflict with it because ultimately, you know, politics boils down to your wallet. And, you know, all politics are local. And you can't get any more local than my wife's pocketbook.
There you go.
It's really a struggle.
So what's your point, John?
well, it's just that, you know, you have to kind of look at these energy corporations aren't as evil as we think they are.
No, I'm not. I am not saying that they're evil, John. What I'm saying is that you have companies within an industry, the industry being energy, trying to keep that industry narrow and controlled, when in fact that industry, if it were widened up and opened up, would have the potential to create an economic boom in this country that would make the computer revolution look puny. If we were to decentralize energy, if we were to, you know, make it easier and easier for people to put solar on their homes, put windmills up, things like that. I mean, these technologies are now here. It actually is possible for the United States to generate all of its electric needs from renewable power. And with just small incentives from the government, or just letting the free market do it, you know, without the government subsidizing the oil industries, we could see a transformation like, you know, that would be absolutely wonderful for the United States. And what's standing in the way of it are the oil companies. And it's not that they're evil people. They're trying to protect their profits. I mean, it's the human imperative.
You know, I can't disagree with that. And the thing that really blows my mind ultimately is these raw materials, these resources are going to run out someday.
That's right. It's not just that they're going to run out, John. We hit the peak in 1972 in the United States, and it looks like we're hitting the worldwide peak this year. John, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour.
I'm a bit unstable.
Uh-oh.
She said with a Cheshire grin.
Okay. Welcome back, my friends. 55 minutes past the hour, or four and a half minutes before the hour. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, high technology for low prices, 1-800-511-MAX. Our quote for the day from Mahatma Gandhi: the things that will destroy us are politics without principle, pleasure without conscience, wealth without work, knowledge without character, business without morality, science without humanity, and worship without sacrifice. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Xavier in Santa Cruz. Hey, Xavier, you know, you can hear us now on KRXA in Monterey, California. Gets into the Santa Cruz area.
Okay. Well, I'm in the mountains. What's the call letters on that, do you know? Or the frequency?
I don't know the frequency. It's
okay.
KRXA, though. You should be able to find it fairly easily there.
Okay. Well, I'll look into that. I wanted to mention something about, I was thinking about my parents who are Republican and how I've...
Excuse me, it's 1490 a.m., I am told by Scott here.
1490 a.m.
Yep, check it out. They carry all three hours of the program. So.
Okay.
Anyhow, as you were saying.
Okay. My parents are Republican, and I've pretty much given up on arguing with them. Every once in a while, like the robe thing, you know, it's such a forehead smacker. Why don't people get it, you know? But they watch Fox News. And it's a history, you know. It's the way your brain chemistry works. You've absorbed information over a period of time, and you're invested in it.
Right.
And what I'm thinking is, I heard this somewhere else. I don't remember where, but you have to allow people a way to save face if they're going to change. And I
sure.
think that this is even among Democrats. You know, if you don't allow people a way to kind of, you know, think that it was their own idea, then you're going to constantly. They're just going to keep.
Yeah.
Pushing themselves further,
you know,
further away.
I agree with you, Xavier, and I think that's something that important that we need to do. The other point that we need to remember is that when Republicans and Democrats talk about morality, very often they're talking about different things. Conservatives, by and large, when they talk about morality, they're talking about private behavior, how people behave in private, in their bedrooms, in their homes. When progressives or liberals talk about morality, more often than not, they're talking about public behavior. That is, how are we all, you know, if there is one hungry among us, then we are not moral. If there is one homeless among us, then we are not fully moral. If there are those in need among us, we are not moral. If there are wars that we can resolve and turn into peace, then we are not moral. So by and large, liberals, I think this is just brainwiring, liberals are concerned with morality in the large public sense, and conservatives are concerned with morality in the small private sense. And that's simply going to be always with us. So I think what we need to do as progressives is acknowledge the private morality issues and discuss them as well in an appropriate frame, and try to help conservatives understand that there's public morality issues as well.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. A bit of an error there. KRXA, our newest affiliate in Monterey, California, reaching down into Santa Cruz, California, is 5:40 a.m. Got a call from Hal, the program director, station manager there. Great to hear from you, Hal. Thank you for your kind words. Another great fan of Jimmy Carter, one of our finest presidents. And Hal says 5:40 is the frequency. So my mistake for getting it wrong. Excuse me, my apologies. We had a hasty Googling, as they say, a hasty Googling. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. TomHartman.com, the website, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, one of the few live chat rooms where you can hop in, say anything, interact with folks. The demographic I find is fascinating. It seems to me that there's just about as many women as men in our chat room, which traditionally I think the thinking was that computer geeks were all guys and chat rooms were a guy thing, and that but it really shows that gender is not the issue here. I think it's wonderful. And you know, there used to be this, I remember years ago in talk radio, there used to be this conventional wisdom, this was in the Limbaugh days, that only men listened to talk radio, and so everybody was trying to sell male products. And we find in talk radio, in progressive talk radio, that women are listening as well, and you know, congratulations, that's a marvelous thing also. So anyhow, I wander a bit off topic and a little bit inside radio or inside baseball, but I think it's fascinating just how all these things work. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Jerry in Rutherford, North Carolina on the line. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
I got a question. Can you explain something about the Espionage Act of 1917? I heard it mentioned the other day in terms of the relevant parts of it to today's situation with the Roe and plane, and I know nothing about it. I just wondered if you knew anything.
The Espionage Act of 1917.
Right.
Okay. This, as I recall, this thing was passed right after we entered the First World War, and it had a 20 years in prison and a $10,000 fine, which was big money in 1917, for anybody who interfered with recruiting of troops or who disclosed information that would harm the national defense. And this, I got this from spartacus.schoolnet.co.uk, by the way, the website on it. Additional penalties were included for refusal to perform military duty. And over the next few months, over 900 people in the United States went to jail under the Espionage Act. This is part of the, you know, Woodrow Wilson was soundly criticized for many of his policies with regard to World War I. One of it being that he was one of the first presidents, he was the first president of the United States to use the public relations industry itself to try and get us into a war, which he did, World War I. And then in addition to that, he passed the Espionage Act and several other pieces of legislation that many people feel were very unconstitutional or at the very least repressive. And here's this guy. He was a Democrat. And I am among those who criticize Woodrow Wilson for having done this. Eugene Debs was arrested under this. Bill Haywood, Philip Randolph, Victor Berger, John Reed. Eugene Debs is probably the name that's most famous. He was sentenced to 10 years for a speech he gave on the 16th of June of 1918, simply attacking the Espionage Act. So, how's that for a start? Yeah, there was also a newspaper called The Masses, which was a socialist newspaper. They were prosecuted in 1918, and during the Red Scare, this is 1918 to 1920. The Attorney General and his special assistant, a guy by the name of J. Edgar Hoover, used the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, which was the big one that Woodrow Wilson passed that has since been repealed, to launch a campaign against radicals and left-wing organizations. And they nailed 1,500 people. They arrested J. Edgar Hoover and Mitchell Palmer, 1,500 people. Go ahead.
Well, are any parts of it still intact today, or have they been seceded by other laws and regulations?
Well, I know that the Sedition Act has been repealed. As far as the Espionage Act goes, you know, I don't know. Let's see. Perhaps somebody in the chat room. Very often, they're right on top of this stuff. Well, let me just toss it out and ask the chat room if they know. And probably within a few minutes, some of them are listening on the web and they get a bit of a delay. But we'll find out. Okay.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Jerry. Good to hear from you. It's, you know, this is, here we have, you know, the Patriot Act is up for renewal in the House of Representatives. It looks like it's perhaps, well, actually, was it just passed last week? I haven't been keeping up. I was over the weekend in Chicago for the ILCA meeting and just general madness here. I should know that. We'll find out. Anyhow, the Roe v. Wade being overturned. In addition to this, the raging grannies. Now, this isn't a Roe v. Wade story. This is back to the, you know, lying us into a war in Iraq. In Tucson, Arizona, a group of senior citizens known as the Tucson Raging Grannies. Now, keep in mind, the Raging Grannies nationally were among the groups who were being investigated by the FBI. Yes, by the FBI, as a potential subversive group under the Patriot Act. So, anyhow, the Raging Grannies, they showed up at a recruiting center. This was not, you know, protests, signs, marches, stuff like this. No, they showed up at the recruiting center. These are women in their 70s and 80s. Showed up at the recruiting center and said, send our grandchildren home and send us. We're here to sign up. We want to enlist in the U.S. Army. We understand George Bush has raised the recruiting age so that more people can join the military because he's so desperate to get people to go over to his illegal war and, you know, come up with a, you know, why don't you take us? And they did not receive a friendly welcome. They said they want to enlist in the U.S. Army to go to Iraq so their children and grandchildren can come home. Five members of the group were arrested. They're due in court today, and they've been protesting for weeks outside the recruitment center. But this time, instead of protesting, well, as Betty Schroeder said, 74-year-old Betty Schroeder, she said, we went in asking to be sent to Iraq so our kids and grandchildren can be sent home. But rather than listening to us, they called the police. She says, leave it to the raging grannies to know how things are supposed to be. She says, it wasn't their place to tell us. It was their place to tell us the qualifications, but they wouldn't even speak to us. They should have said, you're too old. Instead, they sent him to jail. Schroeder said she hopes the trespassing charges will be dropped and an apology given to the group from the Tucson Police Department and from the recruiters. She says this was not a performance, a joke, or civil disobedience. This was an enlistment attempt. The Raging Grannies actually trying to join the Army, trying to go over to Iraq, trying to participate, and never did. Instead, bang, they got tossed in jail. In the meantime, we find Dick Cheney has said to his generals, now get this, keep in mind, when George W. Bush, before I give you the story, just a little backstory here, when George W. Bush came into office, first of all, a year before the presidential election, 1999, he told his biographer, the guy who was working on his biography, his autobiography, A Charge to Keep, the book that he supposedly wrote. It's in the bookstores. He talked to this guy and did a bunch of interviews. And then when they were all done, they read him his book. And he told this guy that if he became president and he got a chance to invade Iraq, he would not waste the political capital from that like his father did. Now, keep in mind, the reality is that George Herbert Walker Bush, George Bush Sr., invaded Iraq and made it a 100-hour war. I mean, basically made it a 3-day war. It was a very, very short thing and didn't go on to Baghdad and was very proud of that. And the political reality is that if George Bush Sr. had turned it into a 3 or 4 or 5 month war, yes, there would have been many, many more dead people. Something that George Bush Sr. well understood. He fought in World War II. His plane, he was a bomber pilot. His plane was shot down over the Pacific. He understands what it means to struggle, to die, to see people die in a war. He knows the horror of war. And therefore, he didn't want to have a protracted war. But if he had, he probably would have easily beat Bill Clinton in the election in 1990. He probably would have easily, or 92 it was. He probably would have easily beat Bill Clinton. If he had simply stretched that war out another 6 months. And because, you know, Americans tend to re-elect wartime presidents, a lesson that was not lost on George Bush Jr. So anyhow, Bush Jr. tells his ghostwriter for his autobiography that if he gets a chance to invade Iraq, he's not going to waste the political capital from it like his father did. He's going to use it to get his agenda done. His agenda, roll back the New Deal. Privatize Social Security, do away with unemployment insurance, do away with restrictions on companies, on corporations, let's make environmental controls voluntary, gut the Labor Department, turn it into an anti-labor group, gut the Education Department, privatize education, start handing out money, billions of dollars from the federal government to churches so that they'll support the Republican Party, cement the Republican majority in the House and Senate, and you can do it all with a nice war. And he did. And we know now from Paul O'Neill, the Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill says, hey, the first day that Bush came into office, we had a meeting and he said, I'm going to take out Saddam Hussein. We're going to go after Iraq. First day in office. We know that in the first few months, in April of 2001, long before 9/11, Dick Cheney was meeting, had his energy meetings, and he was carving up the oil fields of Iraq for the oil companies. This was not any big secret that Cheney wanted to do this.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
But, you know, Bush had to pretend like we really weren't going to go to war.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
And of course, he had to reinterpret the meaning of war.
That when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
But ultimately, I think we figured it out, because when George Bush said to the Iraqi people, we're going to start bombing, to the American people in his announcements, he said, we're going to start bombing Iraq in 48 hours. And then he said, and now I have a special message for the Iraqi people. And he turned to the camera, and all of us, I think, were expecting him to say something like, you know, your soldiers are just like our soldiers. They don't want to die any more than ours do. But no, this is what he said.
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And at that point, all over the world, particularly the Arab world, people said, oh, now we get it. Now we know what's going on. Now we know what his real agenda is. His real agenda is oil. And, you know, there you go. One of the reasons why the entire Muslim world, the entire Arab world is very, very concerned with us and, Not seriously, not taking us seriously when we say, oh, it's all about democracy. Yeah, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Just like when we installed Saddam Hussein in the first place, it was all about democracy. Just like when we overthrew a democratically elected government, installed the Shah of Iran, it was all about democracy. No, it wasn't. It was about oil. But in the case of George W. Bush, it's even worse. It wasn't just about oil. It was about politics. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, some people think that unions are too strong. Union leaders should go back where they belong. But I wish that they could see a little more poverty and they might start to sing a different song.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com. Our website, if you want to drop into the live chat room. Welcome to the vast radical middle conspiracy, my friends. Take no imitations. Ellen Ratner is with us, our bureau chief in Washington, D.C., and Greg Gorman. Greg, what's your official title?
My official title is Supreme Court correspondent.
Okay. Senior Supreme Court correspondent.
Senior, okay. That's perfect. I like
senior,
your thinking, Tom.
Senior Supreme Court correspondent.
I like the way you think.
And Ellen Ratner, our senior bureau chief, is with us, right?
That's right. You got it.
Okay. What's up, guys?
Well, first of all, Greg did pool today at the White House. It's our turn today. And it's very interesting. He's going to sort of fill you in on what the buzz is, because Greg and I had exactly the same reaction when we saw the White House schedule this week. Greg?
Well, this is what we think the buzz around town is, or around the White House. When we saw the week ahead, we noticed that there were not a lot of heavy events. Every event was pretty much being called a photo release by the White House. And that means that instead of having either a press availability or pool coverage where you go in and watch what the president does and says, they were only going to release a photo of the event. In other words, if someone's in the Oval Office, instead of having pool go in with you to cover whoever that person's day is, then they were just going to take a photo.
In other words, nobody will be allowed to ask questions.
And that means there are no questions, and probably the White House does not want the press corps getting anywhere near the president this week. Now, there are a few new things that have come up, especially in this afternoon briefing, mainly about these documents that people are requesting from Judge Roberts. So that's one issue. And, of course, then there's the Karl Rove CIA leak.
Right. What did Bush know, and when did he know it?
And also, what did Andy Card know, and when did he find out that there was an investigation? When did he let people in the White House know? Apparently, if he was briefed by the Attorney General, at what point did he wait until he told the rest of the people in the White House that there was an investigation?
Right. And how many documents and emails
and
got shredded in the meantime?
Exactly. Apparently, it could have been up to 12 hours, which means what could have been changed or strategized in that time. So those are two big issues this week. And because the president is doing things like going to an art museum this morning and there are no questions from the press, the White House is trying to keep the press as far away as possible.
Interesting. You can tell they're in trouble.
Well,
Both Greg and I think we looked at the schedule last night. Both of us independently said, what is going on here?
Yeah,
exactly.
And
I
it's interesting, the other press, Greg, I mean, isn't it right in the van people had exactly the same reaction?
Yeah, in the van, all the photographers that were in my van with me, because we ride in press van number 2, all the photographers were thinking, what is going on with all these photo releases? Why are we not allowed to ask questions? So then they called. It wasn't on the schedule. The president went to the Egyptian embassy and signed the book of condolences for the bombing victims from Sharm el Sheikh over the weekend. And so we all...
That would have been a great time for him to give a few words.
Well, exactly. And what happened is everyone was speculating, all of us in the press, is there going to be a statement? Are we going to be able to ask questions? And sure enough, we get to the embassy. They signed the book. They, being the ambassador and the president, made very short remarks how the U.S. will stand with the people of Egypt, how the people that did this are cowards, how the people that were killed were only doing their jobs, and they were trying to make a living. And they kept us very far away. The president was then ushered out right away. One hand did not even attempt to go up, and he was gone.
Yeah. Yeah, these guys, they are in deep trouble. The question of, you know, what I posted on commondreams.org last week, Treasongate, what did the president know and when did he know it? That's a question that now the Washington Post has actually asked. I mean, you know, there's a couple of national publications that are actually asking, what did the president know and when did he know it? And then the whole thing with Andy Card and how many documents got shredded and when.
Gonzalez. Before from my cousin who is a white-collar criminal attorney, the problem is always the first lie.
There you go. Yeah. And apparently there's more than just one lie in this case and more than just one liar. Ellen Ratner, Greg Gorman, brilliant. Thank you for being with us. Thanks for
coming
from
you,
Washington,
Tom.
D.C. We'll see you guys
Got
tomorrow. Take good care of yourselves. Keep out of the line of fire. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. Dum, 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 dum.
Welcome back, my friends.
Only the lonely
Only the lonely.
Oh, my.
I know the way I feel tonight.
Roy Orbison. I remember seeing him in New York City live. He wasn't even supposed to be on the bill. I was just in a little coffee house, and he just showed up and did an hour and a half gig and show, and it was just absolutely amazing. Anyhow. You can tell I was a DJ at one point in my career. It was 30 years ago, but I still love good music. Welcome back, my friends. 26 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Of course, the official message we just heard from Greg Gorman and Ellen Ratner in Washington, D.C., our correspondents in Washington, D.C., the official message from the Bush White House.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Yes, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. 1-866-889-8894. Alice in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
I don't believe that our wartime president did get reelected, and I don't think that you believe he did either.
No, I don't. I believe the exit polls, that he lost by about 3 million votes.
Yep, that's right. And... with their ethics, they have no problem with rigging elections.
The true tragedy, Alice, you know, whether they rig the election or not, and people of good conscience debate that and argue it, but the true problem is that we have now privatized our vote. It's the ultimate crime of privatization, that our vote is now being handled by private for-profit corporations who refuse to do it with transparency. They tell us that we have no right to see our vote from the time we push the button or punch the pad or paper or whatever it may be. From that time until they tell us how we voted, they refuse to tell us how they're handling it, refuse to allow us to see that, and that, in my mind, is the ultimate crime against democracy.
That's right.
Alice, thank you for the call. It's always nice to hear from you.
Okay, have a good day.
Thank you. You too. And thank you for listening on KGOE. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Billy in Santa Cruz, listening on 540 KRXA. Hey, Billy.
Hey, buddy. You know, I just want to thank you for the freedom. And by that I mean, you know, you're on the radio in this Bay Area of ours, this beautiful Monterey area.
Yeah, it's great. You've been listening for years on Sirius and on the Internet, and now I'm on a station in your backyard.
I can leave my house before noon. It's a miracle, I'm telling you.
Baruch Hashem.
So I want to apologize for not coming on sooner, because my job was to welcome you to the air and give the call numbers and all that, and because I didn't do it, you guys screwed it up, so it's really my fault.
Okay. Well, and Scott is over here saying, no, it's his fault.
Exactly. No, it's my fault.
Okay.
That was my job.
All righty, Billy. It's all your fault.
Now, quickly on George Bush, because I can't miss an opportunity to tell the truth about George Bush.
There you go.
You know, here's what we learned about Republicans in general, not just George Bush. But if we didn't learn it from Nixon, then we learned it from, you know, the way these guys all behaved when Mark Felt was revealed, and again with the Roe thing. Republicans are loyal only to each other, never to the country. When you give out CIA names, when you let your president lie to cheat and steal elections, like for Nixon or for Bush, that loyalty is, in fact, treason, isn't it?
You know, I'm not disagreeing with you on the general principle, Billy, but however, John Dean did tell the truth before Congress. There are Republicans who are loyal to the country and put that loyalty.
Saying, remember,
there are a few.
You haven't spoken to me for a while, so you probably forgot the 80% rule. Everything I say is only true 80% of the time.
Okay.
There's always 20% of some group that's, you know.
I mean, I know there are some good Republicans out there. My parents, for example, are Republicans, and they still remember the days when they still are, honest to God.
They voted for Bush?
I don't know. I don't, you know, one of the things I don't do anymore is argue politics with my parents. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, they are Republicans, and they remember the days of Eisenhower and Barry Goldwater and Everett Dirksen, when Republicans actually stood for something and believed in something and had some semblance of integrity. And, you know, to them and to all the other good Republicans out there, and there are, as you say, that 20%, there is a small minority of them. I say, please take back your party. Please take back your party.
Exactly. Our message to the Republicans is our same as our message to the Islamic community, which is you need to put a fatwa out against those people in your group who are responsible for taking you far away from the good place you could be.
Yeah, and I would say the same thing, by the way, to Democrats about the DLC.
Yeah, look, it's true for all of us. And in fact, that's the ultimate thing that I'm going to leave you with, and that's this question. I know we're not supposed to say this because the Republicans want us to, but I'm going to say it anyway. If we went to Iraq without the reasons that they were being aggressive towards us, if they didn't have nuclear weapons, and if they weren't coming, then aren't we terrorists? And aren't we worse than the terrorists because we know better?
Well,
and if we don't ask Bush, if we don't take Bush down, if we aren't responsible, like we want the Islamic community to go out and get bin Laden, I want them to do it, well, I think we need to impeach George Bush because he killed innocent Iraqis, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, and
so we don't have high ground. I want to be able to say to the terrorists, "There's something wrong with you, sick people."
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing to say that we're terrorists, Billy. But I'm telling you, much of the world thinks that we are, and certainly much of the Islamic world thinks we are. Thanks for the call. I appreciate
it. Welcome to the Bay Area.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be there, and a great honor to be on 540 KRXA. And in fact, you know, this is George W. Bush, you know, saying repeatedly. That I mean, just you know, basically coming up with stuff, just making up stuff. The Bush war lies are just absolutely breathtaking in many regards, and it's yeah. Here I sound speechless. The reality is that sometimes I am. I mean, it's just the audacity of George Bush to just, you know, toss stuff out and just say you know that well. First of all, every now and then there's an unguarded moment when he actually tells the truth, okay? Here's one.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No evidence that Saddam was involved with September 11th. No. But then on the other hand, now get this. Listen to this. First of all, this is Bush talking about the infamous 18 words in his State of the Union speech that Joe Wilson outed, that then Bush got the memo on Air Force One and apparently called Karl Rove or else called Dick Cheney. One or the other of them said to Rove, who was Bush's assistant, and to Libby, who was Cheney's assistant, start dialing for dollars, start calling reporters all over the country, and out this guy's wife. We're going to bring him down. We're going to teach anybody in the CIA, anybody in the diplomatic corps, anybody in the State Department, which is where Joe Wilson used to work, that if they dare to cross us, we will take down their family. You know, in the finest mafia tradition. So starting out, here's George W. Bush basically trying to place blame for those 18 words, even though they had been removed from a previous speech, because Stephen Hadley, the assistant to Condi Rice, had said, "Hey, this stuff is wrong." They removed it from a previous speech, trying to lay the blame for this on the CIA. First of all, he starts out with that.
Subsequent to the piece of speech, the CIA had some doubts. But when I gave when they talked about the speech, when they looked at the speech, it was cleared. Otherwise, I wouldn't have put it in the speech. I'm not interested in talking about intelligence unless it's cleared by the CIA. And, as Director Tenet said, it was cleared by the CIA. The larger point...
Now, by the way, the day after Joe Wilson's op-ed appeared in the New York Times, Condoleezza Rice apologized for those 18 words, as did George Tenet. But nonetheless, here's now... Now, keep in mind, when the UN passed Resolution 1440 and said... Weapons inspectors have to go into Iraq, and if they find any evidence of weapons, on certification of the inspectors, and that was the caveat, on certification of the inspectors, if Hans Blix or Mohammed al-Baradei, Hans Blix looking for conventional chemical and biological weapons, Mohammed al-Baradei looking for nuclear weapons, if either one of these two guys says there are weapons there that are illegal, then the coalition, this group of countries, can attack. Okay, and Saddam Hussein said, fine, bring in the inspectors, and gave them free rein to the country. And Bush pulled the inspectors out the day before he started the bombing. He said, you guys, and Blix was like, no, just give us 2 more weeks. We'll prove to you that there's nothing here. George W. Bush says, no, you have to come home. But here, George Bush continues.
Point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
And these are just breathtaking lies. He had a weapons program? No, he didn't. He had And he refused to let the inspectors in? No, it's not the case. And this was after the invasion, after the successful invasion. Oh, my. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, what's up? I just don't understand why the Democrats don't make the voting issues a platform issue for 2006, but that's not really the point.
You mean the voting machines?
Yeah.
I agree with you.
They should just be making it a platform issue so that even if they lose, it'll be highlighted.
Yeah.
But either way, I just wanted to say, how much of this Rove thing is a war between the CIA and the White House?
I think a substantial portion of it, frankly.
Yeah, because, I mean, they just couldn't purge enough people. I mean, I guess that's what's happening, or at least the people that were purged are talking.
Yeah, Porter Goss in there. There was an excellent book written maybe 20 years ago called something like The Ivy League versus the Cowboys. I'm sure I'm misremembering the title exactly, but about the two factions within the CIA, one faction being the professional Ivy League kind of State Department-leaning intelligence, and George Herbert Walker Bush, by the way, was a member of that, and then the other group being the down-and-dirty cowboys, the ones who, you know, wanted to get out there, get their hands dirty, get involved in intelligence, and really didn't care for the niceties of is it legal or is it not legal, and they were largely led by the faction of the folks, the Bill Casey faction, and the folks who came in, the Nazis who came into the CIA after, or the OSS at the time, after World War II, and kind of remade the agency. And that battle, that war within the CIA has been going on for 50 years. It's been going on since World War II. Now we have this war on the CIA by the Bush administration for not supporting his lies. And that's, I think, why Porter Goss got put in there, was to clean out anybody who might speak up. And he did.
Yeah.
And then now that Porter Goss is, you know, one of the things, you join an organization, you tend to become part of its culture. Porter Goss is becoming part of the CIA culture, and so Bush had to demote him as well. So now Porter Goss reports to Death Squad John Negroponte. Interesting, he goes down to Honduras, all of a sudden there's death squads and people are showing up headless. He goes over to Iraq, suddenly there's death squads, people are showing up headless. Now he's in charge of all security in the United States, and the Bush administration is saying that they have every right to disappear Americans and not tell us about it.
Strange. But are the Republicans going to let themselves be taken down by this administration like they were with Nixon? I mean, are they going to let it happen?
I think so. I really think
that's
so.
Really stupid.
You know, well, it is, and there are some Republicans who are fighting that, and some who are trying to make hay while the sun shines about it. You got Chuck Hagel out there, the former president of the voting machine company that became ES&S, trying to challenge the administration in a fairly soft way. John McCain occasionally challenging them, although he needs them. Problem is, George Bush runs the apparatus of the Republican Party. So if anybody wants to run for political office, he can do so much more damage, actually, to a Republican than he can to a Democrat.
He's doing damage to him now by what he's doing.
I know, but at least they think that they have power. And we'll see what happens in 2006, and we'll see how rigged these voting machines are, and whether or not they're going to be able to get away with the same thing that they did last time. You read what went wrong in Ohio. You get this Sproul and Associates company that got millions of dollars from the RNC to travel all over the United States and set up these little tables out in front of federal buildings. And Logan, thanks for the call, by the way, from New York. It's great to hear from you. And they set up these tables outside federal buildings and county fairs and wherever, you know, libraries, and said, register to vote here. And people would register to vote. And if they, and then, you know, you check the box, do you want to vote in the primary for the Democrats, for the Republicans, for the independents? And if they checked Democrat, they would tear them up and throw them away. And there was a TV station in Las Vegas that actually caught this on tape. And they were operating here in Oregon, they were in Las Vegas, they were in Ohio, they were in Michigan, they were all over the United States, it turns out. It wasn't just an isolated local thing, because it mostly got reported on in local media. I don't know of any national media that really picked this story up well. And these guys may have accounted for hundreds of thousands of people who showed up at the polls, Democrats showing up at the polls thinking that they were registered, who were not registered. And then the other thing that they did was they would say, they'd go into heavy Democratic areas with a clipboard and a form on it, and they'd say, do you want to vote for medical marijuana? Or do you want to vote for death with dignity? Physician-assisted suicide laws. Things that traditionally, or do you want to, you know, get us out of the Iraq war? Things that, by and large, a Democratic constituency would agree with. So the Republicans would say, no, I'm not in favor of medical marijuana. They'd walk off. The Democrats would say, yes, I'm all in favor. You know, some small fraction of them, a significant fraction of them, actually, would say, yes, I'm all in favor. They'd say, great, sign here. You fill out this card, put in your name and your address and your voter ID and everything. You got to fill out this card because now the top is covered by the clip on the clipboard, right? What they're doing is they are re-registering their voter registration. And they're registering themselves in a different precinct. So they go to the precinct that they think that they're registered in on voting day. They stand in line for 5 hours. They get up to the front of the line and they're told, oh, you're not registered here. You've got to go someplace else. Where else do I go? I don't know. I don't have that list. So there's eight or ten precincts within 10 miles of them. What are they going to do? Drive from precinct to precinct? Most people give up and go away. Hundreds of thousands of people around the United States. This kind of voter suppression, I mean, even without rigging electronic voting machines, this kind of voter suppression was apparently very, very effective in a number of states. And certainly you read John Conyers' book, What Went Wrong in Ohio, where Congressman John Conyers, the senior statesman of the United States House of Representatives, the senior member, the Democratic member of the House Judiciary Committee, goes down to Ohio and holds hearings and says, what happened in Ohio? And finds that, in fact, the number of votes that were stolen easily exceeds the number of votes by which George Bush supposedly won the state. Bush actually lost Ohio. Yeah, Hartman, he's sounding like a conspiracy nut. No, read the official record. Read the official record. You can buy it in a bookstore. What Went Wrong in Ohio? It's right there. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Have you ever got a note from your bank saying,
greetings, your account just shrank by 25 or 30 bucks. Sorry, friend, you're out of luck. You bounced a check, that's what it was. It happens to the best of us. Please cover it quick.
And when you do, you find you got another one or two. Because what they done, I've never seen it fail. They notified you by the U.S. mail. Cost them almost 40 cents, but more than worth that little expense. Because by the time you receive that letter, their situation got even better. Your first overdraft cost a couple more. Now you own the pile of money for sure.
They hope you never wonder in your little head why they don't send you an email instead. A quicker way and cheaper, too, for them as well as the customer, you.
Or an automated call to your phone or pager would be an improvement vastly major, but they'd lose all those overdraft fees. They charge you a profit center very large. See, that's what they call it. The banks charge you two or three times and then say,
thanks for making us rich at your expense. Thank God you haven't got the sense to ask us, please, won't you install the software that'll place a call or send an email to let you know.
Because, friends, that's how we make our dough.
Welcome back, my friends. From Blue Canyon Satire, Jim Turr, Blue Canyon Productions, BlueCanyonSatire.com. Okay, here we go. 9/11. You'll recall back at Project for New American Century back in 98 saying we need a Pearl Harbor event if we're going to actually have the neocon agenda foisted upon the American people. Loss of liberty, seizing oil lands in the Middle East, all that kind of stuff. And they got it. And they did it. Well, now, according to the American Conservative, a publication well read within the White House, quote, the Pentagon, acting under instructions from Vice President Dick Cheney's office. You know Dick Cheney, he's that guy who's not allowed to drink water while George Bush is talking. Has tasked the United States Strategic Command, STRATCOM, with drawing up a contingency plan to be employed in response to another 9/11 type terrorist attack on the United States. The plan includes a large-scale air assault on Iran, employing both conventional and tactical nuclear weapons. Within Iran, there are more than 450 strategic targets, including numerous suspected nuclear weapons program development sites. Many of the targets are hardened or are deep underground and could not be taken out by conventional weapons, hence the nuclear option. Dick Cheney's office is right now planning nuclear war in the Middle East in the event of a terrorist attack in the United States, and they've already selected Iran as the target. Well, you know, we know from Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary of George W. Bush, we know from Paul O'Neill that in 2001 as they were coming into office. First thing they did, sit down. Hey, let's talk about getting bin Laden. But bin Laden hasn't done any. Excuse me. Let's talk about getting Saddam Hussein. See, they got me doing it. That's what they want. They want us all to think that Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden are the same thing. You know, it's incredible. Anyhow, we'll see you. We'll see you.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his medication. Your light at the end of talk, of the tunnel of talk radio, the Tom Hartman radio program. Osama bin Laden. Writes Mark Perkel, Osama bin Laden won an important victory in the United States House of Representatives Friday as Congress voted to give up the basic freedoms that our forefathers fought and died for. And they have the guile to call it the Patriot Act. What it really should be called is the Cowardice Act, because it shows that America is so weak that we're willing to surrender our freedom over the loss of a mere 3,000 lives in two buildings. Why did hundreds of thousands of soldiers fight and die just to have Congress vote our freedom away? Every time we give up our freedom, the enemies of freedom win. Congress should vote against what bin Laden wants, not with him. Good sentiment, Mark. Thanks for sharing that with us. Every now and then you get one of these things in email. It's just, you know, so succinct and so well said. I just, you know, share it with you as it stands rather than converting it into my own words or what. Yeah, he just, you know, it's just well done. In the meantime, now, it looks like Iraq is an unwinnable conflict. Remember the Boer War of 1899? Or the Suez Crisis in 1956? A couple of disastrous wars that in South Africa and in Egypt that Britain was involved with that ultimately, well, some would say ultimately led to the absolute collapse of the British Empire. Now it's just, you know, it's the United Kingdom, but not quite the kingdom it used to be, you know. In reality, the last time there was a major world empire, arguably the size of the United States, that is, with the power to manipulate as many countries in as broad a scope, was probably the Roman Empire. But in any case, and look at what happened to them. And in fact, Gibbons, the guy, the author of The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, and now it's been, admittedly, 30 years since I read this thing, and I didn't read every word in it. It's huge, but I read a good chunk of it. The wonders of school, right? What you have to study. My recollection of Gibbons' Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire is that one of the main things that led to the fall of the Roman Empire was their involvement in protracted wars in the Middle East. So I'll have to find some specifics on that and share with you. But in any case, this the Suez Crisis, the same thing. You know, Lawrence of Arabia. Over and over and over again, we see that, you know, countries that think, you know, Western countries, Christian countries, for that matter, Hindu countries, you know, the India's attempts to move out of India, countries that think that they can take on the Middle East and it'll just be a quick, easy thing. They're just like totally mistaken. And now we find that the lies of Blair and Bush, energizing, creating, building an entire new generation of suicide bombers. Don Rumsfeld writing that infamous memo to himself in which he asked the question, are we creating suicide bombers at a faster rate than we're killing them? I'd say given the fact that there are an average now of 500 attacks a week in Iraq, the answer is unmistakably yes. A country where before we invaded there had been no attacks, no suicide bombers. Speaking of the lies of George W. Bush, line us into a war purely for political gain. Keep in mind the timing on this thing. Remember the 2002 elections? Just before the 2002 elections, you had Jim Jeffords, the Republican from Vermont. A good man. I have to say, here's my confession on the air. I voted for a Republican 8 years ago, I think it was. I voted for Jim Jeffords. In fact, it was the year 2000. I voted for a Republican. I voted for Jeffords. I voted for a Democrat. It was 2 years before that, I believe. I voted for Pat Leahy. I voted for Howard Dean, a Democrat, and I voted for an independent, Bernie Sanders. And for President of the United States, I voted for Ralph Nader. And yes, you may... I know, I should bend over and take the spanking. Or whatever the appropriate... I didn't make that mistake in 2004. And Ralph knows it, much to his chagrin. But in any case, Jim Jeffords, one of the few Republicans left with some integrity, in 2001, after Bush came into office and started his No Child Left Behind thing, and education was always Jim Jeffords' big thing. And No Child Left Behind, let's make no mistakes about it, No Child Left Behind is the beginning of the privatization of education. It's an attempt to destroy the educational system in the United States. Nothing more, nothing less. Privatize public education. And the first step was to say to schools all across the United States, you must do testing, but you can't do it the way you did when I was a kid back in the 50s and 60s, where the teacher runs off a copy of the test on the Mimeo machine. No, 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 no. That's cheap. You can't do that. No, you have to buy the tests from a private for-profit corporation that owns the intellectual property of the test, the so-called intellectual property. You have to buy that test from that corporation. These corporations, by the way, substantial donors to the Republican Party. You have to buy the test from them, and a test that, you know, might cost you 5 cents to make on the Mimeo machine is going to cost you $20, $25, $30, $35, $40, something like that per student. And by the way, we're not going to give you enough money to pay for it. And so as your local school district goes down the tubes, maybe more and more people will say, you know, except for the poor people who have no choice, because the Republicans really don't care about them anyway. As the schools districts start going down the tubes, maybe more and more people will start moving to private schools. This is a backdoor way of privatizing education. That's what No Child Left Behind is. Just like the private accounts in Social Security is a backdoor way of privatizing the Social Security system. Now, why would the nasty Republicans do this? For the best of motives. They really and truly believe that public education and the Social Security are socialist. And therefore, they're a threat to the American way. They have this dream of the American way being nothing but a nation of big multinational corporations and worker bees happily droning away in the hives and cubicles of corporate America. And they really believe that that's going to be the best thing for this country. And, of course, they're wrong. But nonetheless, they go along with this. So here we have the ongoing destruction of the United States. And in the middle of this thing, as Bush is, you know, moving along his agenda, they tried to inflict it on Iraq. One of the very first things when we took over Iraq, at first when we took over, the first general there, the first viceroy, he said, okay, we're going to hold elections and, you know, turn this country back over to the people. And had we done that, we might have been able to get out, but the problem is we would have left all that oil. And if you had elections, you'd end up with the Shia running the country. And that's what Iran wanted. See, Iran had been fighting this war with Iraq for a few centuries. But they had this really hot war, this eight-year war, where a million people died between Iran and Saddam Hussein. Because they were saying, hey, you know, Iraq is a majority Shia country. It should join Iran. It should become part of Iran. So what did they want? They wanted Saddam Hussein out, and they wanted elections. And so we get these guys, Chalabi and these other neocons, and we bring them into the administration, and it turns out that they're actually spies for Iran. And guess what? George Bush does exactly what Iran wants. He gets rid of Saddam and he gives them elections, and now the Shia are preparing to take over. The Sunnis are not liking this, you know, they're murdering people and all that kind of thing, but nonetheless, that's what you got. So the first thing that they did, after they decided not to have elections, then, of course, later they decided they had to have elections because Sistani and El-Sadr said, if you don't have elections, we're going to riot. You know, they had all these huge protests in the streets. But in any case, the first thing they did was they changed the Constitution. They changed the Constitution to essentially privatize everything. And when you talk to Iraqis, we had, I believe it was on this program, might have been on my morning program, we had a couple of Iraqi trade unionists who were coming through on this program. And they were talking about how trade unions are illegal in the public sector in Iraq, which is the largest sector. They're illegal. It's the only law from Saddam Hussein's era that the Provisional Authority kept, number one. Number two, taxes on rich people, toast. Flat tax, 15%. Steve Forbes' flat tax, let's try it out, let's see if it works. They did it in Iraq. How about absolute free trade? Get rid of all barriers, allow any multinational corporation to come in, buy up anything they want, take all of it out of the country, hire anybody who's not even an Iraqi, bring in slave labor from third world countries where people will work for pennies, and expatriate, remove from the country all of the profit. In other words, strip mine the country. Free trade at its finest. They wrote that into the Constitution. What's the consequence of this? You now have 50% unemployment. The only decent paying jobs are in the police and the army, and people are terrified to take them, and those who do put their lives at risk. And the people of Iraq are saying, enough. See, after World War II, liberal Democrats wrote the constitutions of Germany and Japan, and they gave trade union protections, and they gave a 5-day work week, and they gave overtime protections, and they created national health care systems. We did that in Japan and Germany. In Iraq, we did the exact opposite. We created the conservative paradise in Iraq. Now, you tell me, which would you rather live in, Germany and Japan today or Iraq? Because those are the two futures that you can pick for America. And obviously the Iraqis don't like it either. Now, in the midst of this now, all these lies that are being told by the Bushies, the lies are starting to unravel. And last week I mentioned on this program, the issue is going to be, it's not about Karl Rove, it's not about Scooter Libby, it's not about Joe Wilson or Valerie Plame, it's about George Bush. What did the president know and when did he know it? And even on this week's ABC this week, even David Gergen is starting to ask the question, what did the president know and when did he know it? The advisor to three Republican presidents, by the way. This is on George Stephanopoulos on ABC. New York Times asking, what did Bush know and when did he know it? This is an article by Richard Stevenson. I'm telling you, it's starting to get out there. You heard it here first, or read it in my op-ed piece in Common Dreams. Because this, I'm telling you, this is going to reach to George W. Bush. The memo from the State Department saying Valerie Plame worked for the CIA went to Air Force One as Bush and Colin Powell and Ari Fleischer were flying to Africa, and hours later, Karl Rove and Scooter Libby are dialing for dollars, calling reporters. The phone call had to come from George Bush. Everybody else, too far down the pay scale. 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
What's wrong with this picture? There's something I'm not seeing here.
And welcome back, my friends. In answer to an earlier question, Sue in the chat room has done the research, and we found that the Espionage Act of 1918, courtesy of Woodrow Wilson, was repealed in 1921. So, there you go. And I, you know, I trust that as a fairly reasonable, reasonable source of information.
We interrupt Tom Hartman with this John Bolton alert.
Ah, yes, John Bolton alert. This from Stephen C. Clemens, The Washington Note. John Bolton testified before the grand jury in the Valerie Plame investigation. David Schuster of MSNBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews made a whopper revelation about grand jury testimony in the Plame outing investigation, otherwise known as Treasongate. John Bolton has testified about the top-secret document that Colin Powell had aboard Air Force One. According to lawyers, former Secretary of State Powell and undersecretaries, including John Bolton, gave testimony about this memo. And a lawyer for one State Department official says his client testified that as President Bush was flying to Africa on Air Force One 2 years ago, Press Secretary Ari Fleischer could be seen reading the document on board. The timing is significant because the president's trip on, this is from Schuster's report on MSNBC, because the president's trip on July 7th was 1 day after Ambassador Joe Wilson's column was published criticizing the administration. In other words, on July 6th, the column comes out. On July 7th, the State Department memo about Wilson's wife is seen on Air Force One. And on July 8th, Karl Rove has a conversation with Robert Novak. Now, everybody is saying, oh, gee, I wonder if Powell had something to do with it. I wonder if Bolton had something to do with it. I wonder who could have had something to do with it. I'm telling you, those guys did not have the pay grade to call up Karl Rove, the special assistant to the president, or to call Scooter Libby, the assistant to the vice president, and say, call some reporters and commit a felony, a treasonous felony, by outing a CIA agent. They did not. They were not at that pay grade. Colin Powell didn't have the power to call Karl Rove and tell him what to do. Ari Fleischer didn't have the power to call Karl Rove and tell him what to do. The memo was on Air Force One. Colin Powell saw it. George Bush saw it. Ari Fleischer saw it. Of those three men, the only one who had the authority to call the vice president, Dick Cheney, and say, please have your assistant do this, or even to call Scooter Libby directly, the vice president's assistant, and or to call Karl Rove, the president's assistant, was George W. Bush. This is the guy whose fingerprints are all over this. It's going to come back to him. Mark my words. Dave in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Well, Tom, you know, so much destructiveness, so much harmful craziness is coming at us from this White House that every week something that's so significant gets pushed off the burner while we another one. Now, the latest, if I'm hearing you accurately, Cheney is fully setting in place preparations to invade Iran. He hasn't learned a damn thing from how badly his wars are going right now?
Apparently not. My guess is that this has to do with the upcoming elections. And frankly, I'm guessing that it's going to have to do with the 2008 elections, not the 2006 elections. I've been predicting all along, in 2006, he's going to invade Syria or some other country where he knows he can have a relatively fast and easy victory. And in 2008, he's going to invade Iran.
You know, I was thinking of one other thing earlier when you were dealing with my main issue of how they continue to steal these elections. At the last minute, they had crews of thousands to call Democrats and tell them your place of voting has been changed, your time has changed, and some even the day had changed.
So, yes, yes.
To think that they had won this thing credibly is just outrageous, and to think that they're going to try to do
it. Well, it's not possible. I mean, the exit polls were right. George Bush lost by 3 million votes. I was doing election coverage the evening of the election, and I remember at about 11 o'clock Eastern time, I was at WDEV, one of our affiliate stations, and I was doing the election coverage, and we got the report from AP that Karen Hughes had just sat George Bush down to tell him that he'd lost the election based on the exit polls and that he didn't seem to be concerned. And, you know, an hour later, they called the election for Bush. Gee, I wonder why he wasn't concerned. Yeah. Dave, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Good to hear from you. Always good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We're tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I lived with them on Montague Street in a basement down the stairs. There was music in the cafes at night and revolution in the air.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. And Vincent in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT on the line. Hey, Vincent, what's up?
Good afternoon, sir. You are indeed a breath of fresh air here in Pittsburgh.
Well, thank you.
I'd like to make one brief statement and then ask you two questions, if I could.
Two quick questions.
Okay, I want you to understand that the person you're speaking with, and I don't care who's listening, because I know that since you've expanded that they're watching your every move. If you've seen the movie Enemy of the State with Will Smith being the star, have you seen that movie before?
If I have, I don't remember it. I'm sorry.
Okay, he's a lawyer, and the state comes after him because the NSA comes after him because they think he's got a package that was delivered. At any rate, what they do to him, and if you haven't seen that movie, I would ask you to go and watch it, because my statement to you is, Tom, you're obviously you're analyzing everything quite brilliantly, and you become an enemy of the state, if you will. So I would ask you to please be careful. Okay.
Well, thank you, Vincent, and I appreciate that. I consider myself, you know, perhaps politically an enemy of this administration, but I am a patriot. I love this state. I love this nation. And I believe that what I'm doing every single day here is working to bring democracy to the United States, to open up democracy in the United States, to restore our civil liberties, and to reestablish the vision of the founders of this country. And so, and I know that there are many good people in government, even though the administration maybe have been taken over by hacks and thieves and people with less than great integrity. There's still a lot of good people in government, and I am not yet willing to surrender my faith in that.
And I am in total agreement with you. I just say this is someone who's spent, understand, this is someone who spent 26 years in the law enforcement arena, mostly at the federal level, in undercover capacities. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Okay, so I just say that to you. Please be careful, because we need you.
Well, thank you. I'll do my best. And I get death threats in email all the time. I've got two bullet holes in my car. Somebody shot up our car. I mean, you know, it's amazing how often I'll just, you know, walk out of the house or something, and there'll be somebody standing there taking my picture. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that has all started happening in the 3 years that I've been doing this radio program. On the other hand, you know, you gotta keep on doing your life, you know, and so I just keep on doing what I'm doing.
Okay, good.
That's life.
Just be careful, and if I had a team, I'd be there with you 24/7.
Well, thank you, Vincent.
At any rate, my first question, I recall one of your conversations either last week or the week before. I think you were speaking of Madison. You were talking about the relationship of government and corporations and what the founders thought about that. Is there a book that you can refer me to regarding the concepts that were undertaken that you agree with that were debated back in the day, if you will?
Yes, in fact, I wrote the book, and it's an excellent book. And I say that, I mean, you know, I've written a couple of bad books as well. So, I say that with some objectivity, I suppose, because I'll tell you the titles of the books that I've written that are not particularly good books. But anyhow, this book, I put about 4 years into this thing, and it's very well done. It's called Unequal Protection is the title. The subtitle is The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And it starts with the founding of the country, and then builds up to 1886, the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad Supreme Court, when corporations were given the rights of human beings under the Constitution, and then shows how we've seen a steady deterioration of democracy ever since, and how it's been exploited now more aggressively than ever, and what can be done about it, and chronicles the story of people all over the United States who are working to try and roll back what's called corporate personhood, is the name of the legal doctrine.
Okay, so it's called Unequal Protection.
Unequal Protection, right. It's a play on the name of the 14th Amendment, which is the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
Correct. Okay, yep. Now my second quick question is, did you see 60 Minutes yesterday?
I saw a little piece of it.
Okay.
I'm not sure which part you're talking about.
they had an individual on. I don't know if he was a representative of some government agency or what have you, but they were the topic or the subject matter was the fact about the CIA flights all over the world where they're
Yeah, I did see that segment. And we reported on that almost a year ago on this program. That's and in fact that's when the first article appeared. And as I recall, The Nation or Mother Jones, one of the kind of quote leftist magazines, end quote. It's not a secret what's been going on with these secret rendition flights.
And was he a government employee? Because he specifically said to the person interviewing him that he didn't care if they were tortured; that it was okay with him.
Yeah, the guy. This was the guy that they were interviewing. The kind of pudgy-looking guy with the beard. He was apparently the guy
Indeed, that's him.
He was the guy who originally created the rendition program, which, by the way, started under Bill Clinton. And although you know it stepped up dramatically under the Bush administration after 9/11, and my recollection from having seen the program, and I don't have a transcript of it here in front of me, so this is just my recollection, was that he is no longer with the government, that he has either retired or left government service, and that he was portrayed as or characterized as the guy who used to be with the government, who did start the program, but that he's not with the government anymore. And he was expressing, I think, his own personal opinion.
Oh, okay. All right, then. Well, listen, I'm not going to take up much of your time. Once again, be careful, take care, and if there's a God, I sure hope he blesses you.
Well, thank you, and the same for you, Vincent, and
right.
Tag, you're it. We've all got to carry the good message, okay?
Okay. You
know, all righty. Carry it on. Oh, my goodness. Atrocity porn. This is a brilliant article by William Norman Grigg. And about Jumana Hana. Now, you'll recall in when Bush was ginning up the war, when he was trying to, you know, get us all whipped up into war hysteria here. Well, actually, let's even go back before that. Remember back when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait? And a 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl went before Congress and told this story. She said, I volunteered at the Al Adan Hospital. While I was there, I saw Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns and go into the room where babies were in incubators. They took the babies out of the incubators, took the incubators, and left the babies on the cold floor to die. End quote. Remember that? This was on the on October 10th, 1990, in the Congressional Human Rights Caucus meeting. And this 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl, her name, she was only identified as Nayira. Turns out that it was the Washington-based PR firm Hill & Knowlton, under the leadership of former Bush chief of staff Craig Fuller, who came up with this propaganda campaign that the woman had never been in the hospital, that in fact that she was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States, that this was endlessly recycled. It was... it was all over the place. In fact, some argue that story was what gave George W. Bush the moral authority to push the 1991 Gulf invasion, because otherwise we would have said, hey, you know, it's two Arab countries having a war with each other. Why do we care? Whoever wins, they'll still sell us oil. And Saddam was our guy, by the way. I mean, he was our friend. Right? But they had to have this war against Saddam, So this lie was told, and we now know that it's a lie. I mean, nobody is disputing it. Nobody is disputing it. You know, it was Canada's Fifth Estate television program in 1992 that outed it. And when Al Sabah's daughter was confronted with lack of evidence to confirm her story, she said she actually hadn't seen the butchery but had been told about it by a friend. Turns out the friend didn't exist. I mean, it's just the whole thing was made up. So now another one. Bush tells the story about the uranium. Joe Wilson says, no, there is no uranium. At the same time that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby are committing treason by calling reporters and outing a CIA operative, bringing down Brewster Jennings, a multinational CIA operation that was covertly selling or supposedly selling weapons of mass destruction to terrorists, actually collecting their names and addresses and information so they can arrest them, at the same time that the Bush administration is bringing down one of the CIA's most successful anti-terrorism operations purely for political revenge. They're also waging a PR campaign. This woman, Jumana Hanna, an Iraqi. Whole bunch of stories about her. She's a 40-year-old Iraqi expatriate living in Northern California with her mother and her children. This was, and she tells the story that in 1993, according to her account, she had married a man from India. And she said, quoting her, Saddam had made it illegal for Iraqi citizens to marry non-nationals. By marrying Anwar, I would be breaking the law and risking a state backlash. She did it anyway. She says, on November 15, 1993, she visited Usaik Hussein's office at the Iraqi Olympic headquarters. After waiting for several hours, she was seized by three men who bound her, slipped a hood over her head, dragged her away to another room, and tied her spread eagle on a bed. Please, she said, I'm like your sister. Hanna pleaded, if our sister married an Indian, we would kill her, came the brutal reply. For several days, Hanna says, she was raped, tortured, and tormented with blasphemous taunts as she called out to God for help. After one particularly gruesome session, she blacked out only to awaken at Baghdad's Loose Dogs prison, where the daily regimen comprised torture, rape, and a diet of green soup and one slice of bread. Her husband, she said, was also arrested, held in a cell block 100 yards away, routinely beaten and sodomized. 3 years later, the couple was released after their mother signed all her property over to them. In 2001, several years after the alleged events described above, she sent her husband Anwar to sign the documents necessary for their children to go to jail, to school, rather. He was purportedly arrested again and confined in the same cell block for another 3 years. Eventually, his lifeless and mutilated body was handed through the steel gate like a piece of butcher's meat. Okay? Sounds like a horrible story. And in fact, the neocons picked it up. They loved it. Deputy Secretary of State Paul Wolfowitz, before the United States Senate, testifies, tells her story, and says her courage in coming forward to offer U.S. officials what is very likely credible information is helping us root out Baathists. She was given several medals of honor by the Coalition Provisional Authority. Nine Iraqi officers, including a general, were arrested on her word alone. It became, in Washington gone mad, a defining parable. The only problem? Everything about Hannah's story is a lie. She made it all up. The guy who originally wrote the story for Esquire magazine, a fellow writer by the name of Solovich, who thought that she was a hero, decided he'd write a biography about her. And in the process of digging into her story, trying to learn more about it, this story that was used, that was all over Fox News, that was all over ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, over and over and over again, before Congress, Wolfowitz, this was the baby incubator story, only the modern version, Uday Hussein runs rape rooms. He discovers it's all a lie. Her supposedly dead husband, he's alive and well. The law that she said that Saddam passed that said that an Iraqi can't marry a non-Iraqi, no such law. She claimed that she had an accounting degree from Oxford. She never attended Oxford. Oxford doesn't even give accounting degrees. She identified a mass grave site, nothing there. They did a gynecological exam of her, no evidence, no physical evidence to corroborate her story. As it turns out, she actually did spend some time in jail as a prostitute. After arriving in the United States, this is from the story by William Norman Grigg. After arriving in the United States, lost my place here. Where she had been lavished with attention, given a luxurious home, and buried beneath generous financial gifts, Hanna continued to weave extravagant tales about her supposed experiences. Her profligacy and dishonesty alienated several charitable organizations that had offered her donations. Finally, this guy, the author, who had originally helped her promote her story, wrote about it in Esquire magazine, came to the conclusion that Hanna, rather than being a brave witness to horror, was a remarkably successful liar. But it was a very useful lie because it came about in July of 2003, just when the Bush administration was fabricating more stories to back up their lies about Iraq. And it was heavily percolated throughout the press. The 16 words. In fact, the Wall Street Journal cyber flag James Taranto on July 21st, 2003. Hannah's heart-wrenching episode or account offers something more important than the Niger kerfuffle. Opponents to the war, he says, particularly partisan liberal Democrats, have to torture logic in order to justify their indifference to the torture of Iraqis like Jamuna Hanna. Right. Anything to change the topic from the Niger uranium story. Mackenzie, really, what is the Niger yellowcake issue all about? He says, look at this. Look at this poor woman who was tortured. Now, this is not to say that torture didn't happen in Iraq. Problem is, it's happening now. It's happening again. And it's not just happening in Iraq. It's happening in Egypt, and we're feeding them the people to torture. It's happening in Jordan, and we're feeding them the people to torture. It's happening in Syria. We're feeding them the people to torture. It's happening in the Sudan. We're feeding them the people. Yeah, it was 60 Minutes last night. How did the whole thing? It's not that we're bad. It's not that we're good. It's that the Bush administration has been selectively using bits and pieces of information to sell us a war to get political advantage. A war that we didn't need to have, and now we have more than 1,700 dead Americans as a result of it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Remember when old ones died and new were born, life was changed.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, remember when America was a democracy? When we didn't have a Patriot Act tearing apart our civil liberties? Please, we would like to know the truth, and the world deserves to know. Or do we want to say to our government, you know, there are some secrets that are just worth keeping. 87 photographs and 4 videos from Abu Ghraib prison were blocked by the Pentagon this weekend. They were supposed to be released, a Freedom of Information Act filing. They were supposed to be released. And they weren't. Why? Don Rumsfeld says, slack after all, you know, blah, 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 blah. Turns out these pictures are a little more than that. In fact, a lot more than that. According to Seymour Hersh, who's seen them, he says, some of the worst that happened that you don't know about, okay? He says, videos, there are women there. Some of them, you may read, were passing letters, communications to their men. The women were passing messages saying, please come kill me because of what's happened. Basically, what's happening is that those women who are arrested with young boys and girls in cases, children in cases that have been recorded, the boys were sodomized with the cameras rolling. The worst of it is the soundtrack of the boys shrieking that your government has. They are in total terror that it's going to come out. Should the government release these or not? I don't know. I'm having a tough time with this one. We should know. And it is going to inflame the world. But this is right at the feet of the Bush administration, that they allowed this to happen, that Alberto Gonzalez wrote the memo with George Bush that led directly to this, a follow-up on the behavior at the Guantanamo Bay concentration camps. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Hi, I'm David Orrick, maker of the 8-pound Orrick XL Hotel Vacuum. Recently, I was on a Caribbean cruise when the captain introduced me to the head of housekeeping. I asked him to take the Orrick challenge. So he brought his biggest and best vacuum to the main dining room and proceeded to vacuum thoroughly, and I mean thoroughly, around the captain's table. Then I took my handkerchief, put it in my 8-pound Auric XL bag, and vacuumed the same